Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Okay, so the theme of the Buddha's first teaching is still very fresh in my mind, and we did the chanting of it in another version. Last night was the Pali version of the, or not version, the sutta. This afternoon we chanted a translated version, Pali English, like they do in Thailand, and it's a substantial excerpt from that sutta. So I'd say the theme is a very important one to be familiar with, not just so that one has some knowledge of suttas as a piece of information, but as a tool for practicing and reflecting, investigating on one's practice. And this theme of the Four Noble Truths is one that and you can't go wrong. Well, actually, you can. Of course, you can go wrong. You can go wrong doing anything. You can pick it up just completely backwards and create all sorts of suffering for yourself. But that's not why I'm emphasizing it. Learning how to pick up these teachings rightly, skillfully, and being able to apply them so that they're helpful for one's growth and maturity in the practice. That reflecting on dukkha as a theme, and it's such an important aspect of our experience to be attending to, not letting just slip past or distract oneself from it or blame somebody else, something else for it, but being able to use it as a tool to investigate why is it that I do experience discontent or dissatisfaction or dis-ease or suffering in some way, shape, or form? Because those options in terms of response to it are ordinary or common, but they're not useful. That's why the Buddha, there are these Four Noble Truths. The Buddha pointed out that there are, say, responses, appropriate responses to them, so that dukkha was to be clearly understood. And as we chanted that that sense of which is to completely understand it. And that requires a willingness to know it, to not just react out of habit or blindness or fear, aversion. And so this quality of a patient knowing is so important in our developing a practice. I can remember so often as students of Ajahn Chah, all of us at various times going to him and asking questions and wanting tools and wanting answers and wanting clear guidance. And so often he'd keep reminding us or say, learn how to be patient. And it was so frustrating because who wants to be patient with dukkha? Who wants to be patient with discomfort and dis-ease? And one is also because we tend to, our own understanding of patience basically it's just sort of putting up with something unpleasant and so until it's over, as opposed to being present with something so that one completely understands it. That's a different way to hold it. And of course that's what the teachings are pointing us towards, is learning how to be present with awareness and clarity so that we're able to completely understand it. That's the appropriate response to dukkha. This is this cultivation of our mindfulness and awareness and reflective discernment is based on that that tool or that need to completely understand what we're experiencing. So this cultivation of our awareness and this quality of knowing is so essential, and in terms of say like dukkha, dukkha has many translations, but you think of it as suffering, disease, discontent, dissatisfaction. But it's just what is ordinary. It's like when the Buddha describes what is dukkha, what is this dukkha? And it's just really ordinary. Birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, illness is dukkha, death is dukkha. Separation from what one likes is dukkha. Association with what one dislikes is dukkha. Not getting what one wants is dukkha. Those are all ordinary experiences. And they're what we all experience. And whether you're male or female, young or old, in a monastery, not in a monastery, wherever, whatever race, nationality one is, dukkha is ordinary. And so that, but it's and the Buddha using this as a means of giving us an insight or a tool for insight into what our habits of mind are, and Ajahn Jeff does a nice image of the, because oftentimes in the West, one you oftentimes hear that Buddhism is a pessimistic religion because it just talks about suffering, and so it's must be a pessimistic worldview. But that's not really the case. In the same way that you wouldn't call a doctor pessimistic because when you go to see the doctor, they ask you where it hurts. I mean, it would be a not very circumspect doctor who wasn't paying attention to, where's it hurt? Where is it uncomfortable? What symptoms are you experiencing? And so in the same way with the Buddha is using this as a window into our experience so that we can understand more clearly. And of course, we're way more motivated to deal with our discomfort than we are when we're comfortable, at ease, happy. It's hard to rouse oneself out of that good feeling. But when you're feeling uncomfortable, there's a real motivation, and then you start seeing actually how pervasive this experience of dukkha actually is. It doesn't have to be. You don't have to be miserable to be experiencing dukkha. Just it's like being in the hall, nice and cool. And you just walk out the door and you're hit by this wall of heat. It's dukkha. not that comfortable. And just being in a sensitive form, that experiences those discomforts of heat and cold, or hunger or being tired, all of those things, they're really ordinary, but they're part of the experience of the human condition. And learning how to navigate that and neither be intimidated nor obsessed or neurotic about it. It's learning how to be wise and discerning. So that in the same way that how we experience the world physically, we experience it emotionally as well, in the sense that we experience the reactions that we have to praise and blame, or success and failure, or gain and loss. Those are all ordinary level, we're experiencing that all the time. But then emotionally, there's always a reaction and a movement in the mind. It's not, so that sense of going up and down because of changing conditions, there's an experience of instability, uncertainty, this feeling of lack of consistency, and it's ordinary, but it's also dukkha. So that, and it's this is why it's so important that we're willing to completely understand it, and to really understand it, to be willing to reflect on it, to be aware of it. And of course, this is why we cultivate the path of practice that we do, so that it gives us the opportunity to truly be the one who knows, having this quality of Buddho, the one who knows as a refuge, not just as an external one where you think, oh, there's a Buddha somewhere up on the shrine, but one has this quality of knowing within the heart, and that is a refuge. So as we reflect on these truths, it gives us the skill of being able to respond appropriately, and that this middle way, this middle path, both in terms of a middle path of practice as well as a middle path of view, allows us to experience the as in the sutta that we chanted before we began the sitting, that chakukalani, say giving rise to vision. Chaku is the eye, so that vision, seeing, being able to see clearly. And karlani is, you know, it's giving rise, but it's the verb to do. So it's sort of like making. It creates, it's the source of bringing into being this clear vision, clear understanding. Chaku karlani, jnana karlani. Jnana is knowledge, and so in its chant is sort of making for insight. Upasama is peace, so that when it's like leading, upasama is like leading to calm, or leading to peace. It's like one of the in terms of practices that are used in the Buddhist tradition, the recollections, the meditations. The anusati, their recollection, to consciously recollect certain aspects of the teachings and of our experience, so that just recollecting the Buddha, recollecting of Dhamma, recollecting of virtue, recollecting of generosity, recollecting of recollection of death, recollection of the body. There's a whole range of things, but one is upasamanusati, which is recollection of peace, and to be bringing peace up in the mind, both as a possibility, as a goal, but also as a conscious experience, because, you know, so often we're always going on to the next thing. That's the problem of the mind. We go on to the next problem, or the next difficulty, because we're on a certain level. You know, what would we be if we didn't have something to complain about? I mean, it's kind of pathetic, but it's so much of our life is like that. Or we're out of fear, we're always identifying the things that are difficult or problematic, or we're caught on our guard all the time. But to really consciously reflect on those things that are really wholesome, or they're bearing fruit, let's say, as our practice bears fruit. So often we don't, like, so I as a teacher, I hear it quite a lot, where people ask for instruction in meditation in order that they can experience more peace, more concentration, more awareness, and then come back and sort of say, okay, my mind has gotten peaceful. Now what do I do? And sort of like, can you just be peaceful for a while? And it's obsession with doing on to the next thing. So that's dukkha in itself. So that learning how to realize, well, this whole path of practice does lead to, it leads to calm, it leads to peace. But it's also, we have to be willing to completely understand or completely be present with that as well. This quality of knowing is encompassing the all of the areas of experience that we have, so that they these are fruits of the practice that we also need to be attentive to, abhinyaya, to heighten knowing, sambodhaya, awakening, nibbanaya sangvati, and leading to nibbana. That's what this path is for. And the on a certain level, it's quite straightforward and simple, but the habit of the mind to complicate and make things more difficult is kind of endemic in our mind, and so the being attentive to this experience of dukkha, in terms of completely understanding it, being willing to be aware, being present, to see it clearly. And when it's seen clearly, then there's a, you start to see more clearly, well, what's the cause? And that's what, the second noble truth is about the cause of dukkha. And sometimes it does require a certain analysis and an intellectual assessment. But I think more often, what is required, again, is this patient knowing, a willingness to be present, a willingness to be the one who knows. And things start to reveal themselves in a much clearer way, and we have to incline the mind to what are the causes of dukkha, what are those habits that are obstructed, what are the habits that are problematic, but. It doesn't, and when it's something is seen clearly, then being willing to relinquish it, being willing to make the effort to go against it, to not follow it, or to just see it clearly for what it is. It's like so often in the suttas, there's in the suttas, there are occasions when, say, Mara, the personification of the tempter, or maybe like a Lucifer figure in Buddhism, comes and makes trouble for even the Buddha, But the response is more like, what's going on here? And it's, oh, I know you, Mara. And it's that, just that direct knowing of the... And of course, then Mara slinks off with his tail between his legs because he can't do anything. He's known. And that's the... and there are stories of, similarly, monks and nuns, but that responding in the same way, and that's I think a really, either one takes it literally, which is hard for most of us, but figuratively, it's a really important way to respond to those tendencies of, say, habits of desire, attachment, fear, aversion, ill will. Say, I know you, Mara, because that's what's taking one to dukkha. And that's where it's released and relinquished and let go of. And it ceases to have a hold on the mind as long as we're willing to release and relinquish. So this is where, say, Ajahn Chah, because he was such a master at being able to express things really simply, there's only two things you really need to do in Buddhist practice to realize the fruits of practice is just know and let go. And on an intellectual level, that's really easy. But then, of course, there's a few obstacles to knowing really clearly, and there's a few obstacles to really letting go. But coming back to that, constantly coming back to that simplicity of how do I know this clearly? How do I be aware? How do I be present? How do I establish this clear understanding? And then, in the same way, how do I relinquish? How do I let go? And not let go in the sense of dismissing with aversion or running away from it out of fear, but how do I release it in the sense of not feeding it and letting it come to its end and not either pushing it down out of fear or struggling with it in some way, because that just continues to feed it, but a letting go. So often when something like maybe there's some aversion or ill will and if it's just seen as this is dukkha, and it really needs to I'm really torturing myself with it and to be able to let go. It's like, remember Ajahn Chah giving advice to somebody, how do I let go of this aversion and ill will? It's just this I see things that are really wrong, and I get really upset at this person and that situation. And Ajahn Chah said, "Well, just really look at it clearly, and just say to yourself, this isn't worth it. It's not worth the pain of carrying dukkha, and." So that it's not, so it isn't, so again, it's where it's not, you're not trying to annihilate it out of aversion to it or just reacting out of fear with it, but seeing clearly, this is painful and I can release it. And it gives one the opportunity to respond more clearly to those situations when one isn't carrying aversion or fear or desire around with one. This letting go, This relinquishing is very subtle. And that's what the response, say the appropriate response to the cause of dukkha, is this relinquishing and letting go. And then in terms of the cultivation of the path, the appropriate response to the cessation of dukkha, when there's an ending of dukkha, an ending of something that is uncomfortable or leaves one sort of with some dis-ease, then the cessation, when that, say, as that comes to an end, it's let go of, it's released, and to directly realize that, again, it's having to make conscious something that we tend to sort of skip over. We're looking for the next problem, or we're looking for the next difficulty, or we're looking for something else to do, and to really hone in on that experience of that cessation of dukkha, that feeling of peace, or that feeling of of clarity. And then directly realizing it. The causal condition for, say, the arising of cessation of dukkha, the path, that's to be cultivated, that's to be developed. And the different causal processes, you know, we sometimes, like in last night's talk, I was talking about how causes and conditions, like there are causes, which is a bit more direct, and then there's this conditions, the supporting conditions, and those are, that adds a layer of complexity to this causal and conditional process that we oftentimes don't recognize or don't see clearly. And I gave the example of so many cats were eliminated in medieval Europe, that it was a cause and condition for the plague to come back, or to come and to proliferate. And it's easy to sort of think of that, how that happens in, say, as an example of the complications. But that same sort of ripple effect of the causes and conditions is experienced in the other way, and that when we cultivate the path, it's setting causes and conditions in motion for real goodness and peace and well-being to arise in ways that we really never conceive of, hard to imagine even sometimes, the effects of our practice, both for ourselves and for others. And so to be willing to pick up the path where it makes sense, pick up the path where it's accessible to one. So that, because sometimes we think of it as a, okay, I've got to cultivate the Eightfold Path. The first one is right view. Okay, well, I've got to get my right view down, and then I can go on to right intention. And so sort of, it ends up, you start conceive of it as a linear thing. But it's all functioning together. It's all working together, and it's creating a web of causes and conditions that bring us to an experience of peace and clarity and release. So that this path of awakening, you know, some of the things, you know, might make complete sense, and we can see very clearly how that is playing itself out. But others are, there's unexpected benefits or unexpected results that, in a very wholesome way, that we could never have thought of, and so that this being willing to put in these causes and conditions in the path, bringing this path into being. The word that in the sutta itself, the word that the Buddha uses is Mahavetabhanti, and it's the same root that is often used for, say, meditation, bhavana, same root, translation in this, say they use the word developed, and we need to develop the factors of the path, but literally it means to bring into being. That bringing those into being, all these different factors of the path of right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, and those are kind of tags or whatever for other wholesome, skillful qualities that we can be implementing and bringing into being, and they set this wheel rolling of truth, and it's like getting just getting on the bus and going along with this, letting that wheel of Dhamma, getting that rolling. I'm following the path, bringing this path into being, and it takes one to places one might not have conceived of. But it's the on a certain level, it's this kind of the magic of this Buddha, the Buddha's teaching and the path that he laid out for us. So I'll offer that for reflection this afternoon.